This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Are towns lining up to make sure they're not home to the state's next casino? There's an important deadline for a controversial aid in dying bill coming up, and it's the Huskies. Once again, those are just a few of the stories we'll talk about in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining me, as always, is Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankowski.
Joining us is our state budget guru. He's Keith Faniff. He's the budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi, once again, Keith.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
And the State House reporter for the Hartford Current, Daniela Altomare. Hello there, Daniela.
Hi.
We want to start talking with Keith about the state budget, which is our most it's one of our favorite topics, of course. And there's a lot to talk about. Last week, State Comptroller Kevin Lembo announced a projected budget deficit of $172.8 million. Coming up later this hour, we'll discuss some of the people who will be affected by these potential cuts. But let's start talking broadly about where this budget stands. There was this flurry of activity last week, Keith. First, we get the comptroller's number comes out, and then we get something from the Office of Policy Management talking about the comptroller's estimates don't take into account the budget rescissions, which were announced today, essentially concurrent with his announcement. And this list of rescissions is, again, one of these dense lists that probably those of us who don't know what every single state agency is called and what all they do, you probably have to sift through it to make some sense of it. So first of all, what should we make of all this? Once again, this number being higher, some cuts coming out, whether or not the legislature has to do something about it or these cuts are enough. What happened here?
What you should take out of it is the time has just about run out on Governor Malloy's statement there's not going to be a deficit. The deficit is pegged by the comptroller or by nonpartisan analysts is somewhere between 170 and 190 million. The governor did about 14 million in cuts. Okay, that's like if you didn't plan to buy any deli meat and they gave you a pound and you said take one slice off. All right, you've still got a big problem. The main reason though we're running out of time is you're into the fourth quarter. Almost all the money is spent in the second and third quarters. So the money's out the door. It's gone. The only way to close a deficit of that size with cuts is to renege on a huge amount of municipal aid, which has not happened in my 27-year reporting career, or to basically – and I mean gut money for higher education. And even that, I think most of it's out the door. In other words, all that's left for the governor is to pray like crazy that April 15th numbers come pouring in far better than the growth we're already counting on. And I can't find anyone predicting that.
But I just want to make sure we understand, again, as we talk about the budget deficit for this year,
right,
we're still looking at tax receipts coming in not as expected. Of course, the April 15th tax filing deadline is a really big number. What happens if April 15th comes along and then the normal period in which we would know what the filings look like? If we're still in this hole, or God forbid, Keith, the hole gets bigger, what happens?
Yeah, if after about a week after April 15th, so about April 22nd, we're still looking at, we got to downgrade the numbers again. This year, it's mostly a political setback because it's a deficit. We have a small amount of money in the rainy day fund. We could cover it. The bigger problem is what you're hinting at. That's the next 2 years where the deficits are $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion. The governor is already gone from before the election saying no deficit, no tax increases, and don't forget about $300 million in tax cuts for the poor, businesses, retired teachers. The reality that he presented is we do have a deficit. He proposed a $200 million a year net tax increase or just about, and he reneged on virtually all of the tax cuts. And the worst part is for him, nothing changed yet. The forecast for next year right now is identical to the forecast for next year that we had in May that he was working with when they wrapped up all these cuts. So it's kind of like hearing the weather and saying, oh, if it's that temperature, I can go out and play. And then the next day comes and that's exactly what the temperature is and you won't leave the house. That's the problem is nothing changed fiscally. It's just now dealing with it. And I think expectations have really been built that, you know, think good things are going to happen and they're not happening.
You know what I decided? I decided to stay inside and just eat that deli meat that I bought. Colin?
Yeah, I was going to try to work deli meat into my observation. I don't have it right now.
Not everyone can be the deli meat guru, okay?
Exactly. I guess my two overarching thoughts about this are I do think we sort of have seen over the course of 4 to 5 years, a shift in the way Governor Milley does things. I mean, I think he's sort of considerably less hands-on in a lot of ways. I mean, it is increasingly his vision that he will come up with some numbers and he will then just shoot the puck down towards the legislature and say, you guys fix this or figure this out. And I mean, and so the legislature, I mean, it's hard to feel bad for the General Assembly of Connecticut, but I kind of do. You know, I mean, the numbers they get are all wrong and the reality is considerably worse. And it really doesn't seem as though Governor Milley sees it as his job anymore to introduce some kind of reality to that. He really wants somebody else to do that.
He basically said that. He basically said, I presented my budget to the legislature. Now it's their, you know, it's their job. Let them deal with it.
We really have a patient that's got like needs stitches and we put 12 Band-Aids on. I mean, we're borrowing to make debt payments. That's like taking out a loan to make your credit card payments in the governor's budget. He turned in his budget, as Daniela hinted at, over the spending cap and said, that's your job to fix. They've got a mess on their hands and they know it.
Well, one of the things, Kevin Lembo, when he come out with these numbers, he's saying, well, now it's time for maybe deficit reduction planning with the legislature and in some sort of different way of going about this. I mean, what is the process right now, Danielle, about how they tackle this? And what are we looking at the process maybe being? Does the legislature have to sit down with the governor? Does the comptroller get involved and take some sort of leadership position in all of this?
Keith would certainly know the intricacies of this better than I would. But, I mean, I think Colin's right. They have a really, really ugly situation on their hands. They've got all kinds of constituencies that they have to answer for in a way that is probably more direct than the governor does. And, you know, it is. It's hard not to feel bad for them at this point.
One of the things that maybe we feel bad for is something that came up in a story that you wrote this week, Keith, about a note that came out of the OPM office. This is the Office of Policy Management. Ben Barnes, the budget guru for the governor of the state, basically it gives some guidance to state agencies about how they might talk about the budget. And this is important for the legislature because as they try to figure out where should we cut, where should we save money, what your article seems to suggest is they're asking questions and they're not getting a whole lot of answers.
Right. Well, some might even say it's more than guidance. Some might say it's a very firm directive. This story stuck out to me just because of the bipartisan response. When you have Representative Tony Walker, a Democrat from New Haven, and Senator Rob Kane, a Republican from Watertown, in lockstep with each other, I think both of them are kind of looking back going, whoa, how did that happen? But we heard from both sides of the aisle saying the big frustration that they had is they can go to commissioners and ask numbers that questions that have empirical answers. If I want to know how many people are served in this program, they will tell us. But if it involves, well, we want to add back this program, would it help? We're basically getting the same answer, and they're saying the same thing. We support the governor's budget. They were told in a memo, you can provide empirical data, but if it comes for your opinion on things, no. That's new. That's unprecedented. The legislature has always been able to go to department heads and ask them for information, ask them for their opinions on things. They're never going to stand up and say, my boss, the governor's a jerk. But they were allowed to say, well, yeah, this ad back would help. This one wouldn't. They can't say that this year.
And so it's essentially a gag order, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think of a charitable way of looking at this because I don't want to be the guy who always has sort of something bad to say about the porcupine and the way he does stuff. Maybe gag order is a little bit too strong a word, but first of all, one thing that will become clear when we talk about the Middlesex Community College Meriden campus is this is not a process that is suffering from an overabundance of communication right now among departments. You can add department to legislature. So, and I think there are a couple of sort of strains here that manifest themselves. One of them is increasingly Governor Milley is and first of all, I wouldn't be surprised if this was kind of Barnes's idea and that maybe Milley checked the box. I don't know if that's your perception.
I wouldn't want to speculate. I guess I would be a little surprised if they made it an executive branch-wide policy statement without at least clearing it with the governor's office.
Oh, yeah.
But the truth is I don't know. I mean, certainly it's the governor's budget director, so we're still talking about one of the highest ranking people right. in the administration.
So, I mean, one of the things that I'm sort of noticing here, the trend that you notice here is he's essentially saying he doesn't trust his commissioners to communicate effectively about their departments. And what the legislators are asking for, I mean, Beth Bye, another Democrat in Keith's article, said, you know, it may get down to a situation where we have to either cut program A or program B. We'd like the commissioner to say, be able to say, well, really, we get a lot more bang for our buck out of program B. So if you really, if you have to do a Sophie's choice on this, let's go with A. And right now, under the gag order, if that's what we're going to call it, that commissioner isn't really allowed to say that. And so these are his commissioners, right? He appointed these commissioners. If they're his choices, he ought to trust them to be able to communicate with the legislature about what policy is. If there's a problem, then I would say – I mean, one of the problems with the porcupine right now is he's a lot more interested in running other states than Connecticut. You know, he's really interested in running Indiana and Texas and New Jersey. You know, if there's a real problem with him and his commissioners, he should take some time out from, you know, hardball and all this other – and Morning Joe. He should – there should be a law that he can never go on Morning Joe, but that's a separate issue.
In fairness, with the gag order is coming from is Representative Melissa Gibran, who's the highest-ranking House Republican on the committee, called it a politically correct gag order.
Politically correct gag order.
Well, I mean, if he's got that kind of problem, I would say spend some more time in the room with your commissioners, getting your story straight, getting your message straight, because there's just no point – in having a commissioner who makes $150,000 or $200,000 a year who's not allowed to communicate with the legislature. It's like a regression to childhood or something. I mean, have commissioners who can go to the legislature and say, yeah, if you have to kill something, kill that, but save that.
You know, we want to talk for just a moment, and Keith can fill us in a little bit more on the world of the spending cap and whether or not it can be circumvented, one of the things that the legislature might have on its plate. But, Daniel, I mean, do you hear lawmakers talking about their options and saying, well, look, this is something we talk about each year. We have to make cuts, certainly, to state government, but we're going to have to find new and innovative ways to raise revenues. And at the end of the day, we always, whenever we're in a hole like this, we get to the point of, are we going to start talking about a new and different class of taxes? What are they talking about up there?
Well, I mean, I remember sitting in on the Human Services Committee budget session, and, you know, there was a steady parade of people coming in, you know, all the liberals saying, you know, until we deal with this tax issue, until we, you know, have, you know, raise taxes on the richest, you know, citizens, we're not going to get anywhere. I don't know if there's any appetite for that. Certainly the governor's locked himself in a box and said, you know, no tax increases with a big asterisk, as Steve will point, Keith will point out, you know, not quite true. But, you know, in any case, you know, to do anything that direct, I just don't see that happening. But
yeah, I mean, did you see any possibility for this, Keith, with the idea that we're going to have to figure out a way not to just solve this near-term problem right now, but solve these out-year problems that we've been talking about? The governor has made some directives about what he sees of the future. He's made these no new taxes pledges, even though in a lot of your reporting you've said, well, essentially, we've raised taxes in a lot of different ways. I mean, is anybody at the Capitol saying, well, if you're going to throw it back to us, one of the things we might just have to do is figure out a way to come up with some new revenue?
I think that's almost a given, because the governor's – I won't get into it all, but the semantics of his no tax definition at this point are so convoluted. He's basically saying, unless I propose a rate change, a percentage change, it's not a tax hike. Yet in the past, when he proposed raising tax revenues by, say, limiting credits, he called them tax increases. Last year, when the Republicans wanted to raise taxes on the poor by getting rid of the earned income tax credit, he put out a press release calling it a tax increase on the poor. So, I mean, his semantics – I mean, he's contradicting himself at this point. And the fact is his own party is not interested in helping him wage that verbal battle. They're not even trying to avoid saying – they don't say, oh, the governor said a tax has tax increases. Oops, what did I just say? They're just saying, look, the governor's already put tax increases on the table. We think we need more. Why can't we have that conversation?
Of course, one of the things that we should be clear about, when we talk about the governor throwing things back to the legislature and saying, okay, we've set up a framework. You need to solve this budget problem yourselves. He's also at the same time sending a message that, but you're not going to do that by circumventing the so-called spending cap, something that is this kind of fictional ideal that we've, I know, broken in the past. Can you just explain where we stand with the spending cap in the states, Keith?
My favorite analogy is kind of like Winnie the Pooh is saying it's really important to cut honey out of your diet. and people aren't mentioning that just last week he was stuck in the honey tree. The governor has moved or proposed moving over $600 million outside of the cap. The truth is our spending cap really has not worked. And that's not a statement about whether we should or shouldn't have one. It's just we haven't really followed it for a decade. Under Governor Rell, she had a different approach. She chose to take advantage of the fact that you can legally exceed the cap. She would sign the emergency declarations, get the extra votes in the legislature. Governor Malloy from the start didn't want to take that approach. But there are a lot – I mean there are a slew of ways. I just give you one example. We give money to charter schools. That's subject to the cap. Now we hand the money to cities and towns and they turn around and hand it to the charter schools. Why? Because about two-thirds of our municipal aid is cap exempt if it goes to poor communities. So just by funneling the money through Hartford and Bridgeport and New Haven, that was just one proposal the governor had that was adopted that saved him about $50 million in cap room. There are tons of ways to do that. We have ways where we intercept money and it's an accounting gimmick. Before it lands in the general fund where it can be counted against the cap, we get it and we assign it to an account off the budget. Well, we have hundreds of accounts outside of the budget. And now it's still for a purpose that we traditionally budget for, like he proposed an intercept last year to cover some of the operating costs for the Connecticut State University system. Look in the budget. They're in there. But he also proposed creating a separate account for that. There are tons of that. And I think the legislature is saying it's not that – we all get that the governor is proposing saying there's no way around the spending cap, be allegiant to it because he wants to control taxes. They just can't believe he's making that argument.
The spending cap was, of course, originally kind of a sop to people who were worried about the imposition of the state income tax. And in all the ways that Keith so expertly demonstrated. That nobody else could explain it as well and as detailed a way as he did. But I think we all sort of realize it is kind of a fiction. One thing you could do is get rid of it and try to budget more honestly. But we're in this whole territory of things you don't want to be the guy who did. So you don't want to be the guy who got rid of the spending cap because then you're the guy who got rid of the spending cap. That doesn't sound good somehow.
The problem is he already did it. Just people don't know it. But he already did.
To go into the tax thing, I just would add to this, and this is my own raw speculation. I'm assuming that Malloy would be delighted if the legislature would come up with a revenue plan that wasn't his, that he could eventually – I mean, he doesn't have enough money to run the government, right? I mean, that's clear. That's sort of a basic truth. He doesn't have enough money to run his own government. If the legislature came to him and said, well, this is what we really have to do, and if he could be put in a position where he could say, oh, what am I going to do? They brought me this tax increase. What am I going to do?
That's more Yogi Bear than
Winnie the Pooh. I
just wanted to make sure you understood the difference between the two cartoons.
There's not a good porcupine character. I mean, you can't do but it's that kind of – I mean, I think he might be kind of thrilled to sort of say, well, no, you don't think so.
I was wondering if Daniela was going to compare the governor to Quick Draw McGraw and we could just keep
– No, I think with the governor's office right now, is they're comparing you to Eeyore, the character
Eeyore.
Who always says something.
Yeah. That's fair.
It's just not right. Well, Keith's fan of our own Eeyore. He's also our state budget guru. He's from the Connecticut Mirror. He's filling us in on the state budget. If you have questions about the state budget, you can call us 860-275-7266. Daniela Altamari is here. She's state house reporter for the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show is here as well. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about some of these budget cuts and where they hit the hardest, including some community college students. That's coming up next in the Wheelhouse, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's Wednesday. The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, is here. Keith Faniff, the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, joins us, along with Daniela Altamari, the state house reporter for the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock. Your Decline of Western Civilization series continues today at 1 o'clock. Colin, you've got another story about things we shouldn't be doing.
Right, exactly. Producer Josh Nalea's Decline of American Moral Fiber series, which – is actually made possible by a grant from Kellogg's Decline of Moral Fiber cereal. And so yesterday we did a show about cheating. Today we're doing a show – actually we're re-airing a show from December, a really good show about lying. And one reason we're re-airing it is because tonight – I'm going to be at Washington School with film critic, America's greatest living film critic, David Edelstein, for a conversation there. People are invited to come. Call Watkinson School and get your tickets. I think there still are some. That's at 7 o'clock tonight. We'll be just having a wide-ranging conversation about movies and also what it's like to be America's greatest living film critic.
Very cool. The Freshly Squeezed series with Colin McEnroe at Watkinson. Again, you can find out more information there on their website. If you want to join us with budget questions, 860-275-7266. And we're going to get back to some more of the things that are being hit with state budget cuts in just a moment. But we should say lawmakers of the state capitol are still discussing plans to open up Connecticut to more casino gambling. Several things came up this week. One is that the Windsor Town Council voted to oppose a casino in that town. You know, we've been hearing about the idea that casinos will help stave off job losses. We've heard a lot of that from Clyde Barrow. He's the guy who used to run an institute on gambling up at UMass Lowell, and now he's working, doing this work for both of the two tribal casinos here, essentially saying we could lose maybe as many as 10,000 jobs if we don't get, you know, very seriously into the gambling business once again. But I don't know, Keith, it looks like, you know, towns might be starting to line up and saying, you know, maybe we don't want the casino in our neck of the woods.
I think that the goal from the beginning was always to aim for Windsor Locks. People saw the perfect combination of it was in the path of the MGM facility in Springfield. You could tie it in with the airport. And I think that's the community there. The tribes are still pinning their hopes on. That community is still in play. But I agree. If it's going to go, it's going to go on the jobs argument. It's not about what money it might mean for the state's coffers.
It's not going to be on the revenue thing, but are people talking about this actually as a jobs plan, Daniela? After all of this talk a couple of weeks ago, I mean, is the state capitol still abuzz about new casino construction?
Well, the Democrats who are proposing this, I mean, you talk to Bob Duff or Looney, and they say it's absolutely about jobs and nothing else. And they brought all the union guys in, you know, one day, a couple of weeks ago, to make a big show, you know, that this was about jobs. Who knows?
I think Enfield also said that they didn't want it, right? It's Enfield and Windsor now. So, yeah, I mean, they're operating on the premise that people sin more around airports, and which is not a flawed premise, I might add.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I mean, this – first of all, I don't believe for a second it's about jobs. And I Clyde Barrow's report, which is commissioned by the casinos, is fundamentally tinctured in that way, if not tainted. And I mean, I just feel like, you know, I always go back to this thing that, you know, to the Music Man, where, you know, Harold Hill comes into River City and tells them to be worried about pool, but he can save them with a marching band. We've actually sort of degenerated to the point where we come into cities and offer to save them with pool, you know, with a casino. This is what we're going to fix your city. With a casino. So Meredith Wilson is turning over in his grave.
But yeah, meanwhile, probably the marching band at your local high school is getting cut because of budget cuts. Let's just go quickly to Tony, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, Tony. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Good. What's up?
My question is, you know, we've got three new billionaires in Connecticut this year. Our millionaires are doing just fine with the rising stock market. And the CEO report from The Current was just out today. With all those outsized salaries, how do we not balance the budget and cut programs like the summer youth employment, which is huge for Hartford youth and breaking the cycle of poverty and discrimination?
Well, Tony, thank you for the question, and we're going to get to some more specifics, a lot of other cuts that are coming. Keith, you did this work a couple of years ago. We've talked about it on the show today, but there's always been this notion that if you raise the top tax rate on some of the richest people, not just in Connecticut, but in the entire world who live in Connecticut, that they will start to flee to tax havens like Florida. They'll go away. Some of the work you've done suggests that doesn't really happen. People don't leave because of tax reasons. Do we know anything more about that?
No, but you're right. It's the biggest myth. If you raise it, they will go. The problem is there's no data to back that up. If anything, if you look – I mean, everybody's got stories from within their district. But if you look at the growth in million-dollar earners, the number of households that filed earnings in excess of $1 million, it grew astronomically between the 2003 recession and the 2009 recession. And even after you adjust for that, by 2011, the growth in those households – was huge, both in what they earned and the number of households earning them. That said, though, I mean, I'm going to bring it back to Governor Malloy again. I can still see a lot of Democrats wincing in his 2011 budget address when he said, when people were hoping he was going to raise the top income tax rate considerably, and he raised it very modestly. He said, I don't believe in punishing success. And this is a line Republicans have used for 30 years to argue against progressive income taxes, both in Connecticut and nationally. We have an administration that firmly believes if we go too high on our income tax rate, we have to be significantly below New York and New Jersey. We'll lose the wealthy. So I don't see that happening.
I just want to quickly read an email from Laureen, who asks, is there any appetite in the legislature to ask the unions to come to the table? I don't know, Daniel, this is the opposite end of the spectrum, right? It's not tax the rich. It's let's get a little bit more from the state employees.
Yeah, except that they already did that. And, you know, now they're locked in again. And I don't know. I don't see them going there. But Keith, what do you think?
I agree. If they were asked, the unions, I'm convinced, would say no.
Yeah. They barely got it the last time after two votes.
Well, and we can talk more about this. I just want to get to one of the cuts that is happening. And it's happening not specifically because of these latest round of rescissions, but it's part of an overall cut that's happening across the state university system. A lot of complaints and concerns coming from some of these cuts. One that's risen to the top this week is the closure of the Meriden campus of Middlesex Community College. Colin, it's about $1 million savings. There's more cuts coming to the system. A lot of people in that town, including students, are saying we didn't even know about this. Who's making the decisions around this? What do you see out of this story?
Well, first of all, everything that you just said is kind of a symptom of the disease. And even for people who follow it, who are not named Keith Faniff, it's getting harder and harder to sort of understand which cuts are coming from this budget, which cuts are coming from the next budget, which things are rescission, which things are cut. And so as a result of that, you get these herky-jerky cycles of cuts, which are very, very difficult to predict and anticipate, even if you're trying to follow it, let alone being a student on a campus in Meriden, and you just don't see this coming. So, yeah, typically people feel very blindsided by this thing. I think this is a nice example, just a kind of microcosm of some of the questions that come up concerning the way that we plan. So this Meriden campus is not a big thing. I think it serves about 600 students. It was, I think, started in 2004 and then renovated, substantially renovated between, I think, 2012 and 2013. So we've got some sunk costs there. I mean, that costs something to do all that.
Now, we do have a lot of sunk costs across the state in bad building programs, too,
exactly.
Not in good ones like this.
But so anyway, if we walk away from that, we're walking away from sunk costs. So what else are we walking away from? Well, you know, I just thought it would be interesting. Yesterday, I sort of looked across state planning. So it looked to me as though at the Department of Economic Development, they're spending some money very nearby this place to crank up mixed use, residential and commercial development around what is going to be the so-called Meriden Transit Center, which I'm pretty sure, I don't know Meriden very well, is very close to this Meriden campus. So they're spending, I think they spent about $600,000 on a brownfield reclamation thing. But so clearly it's a goal to have activity in this part of Meriden. But if you close the campus, you diminish the amount of activity that's in this part of Meriden. The other part of this is that some of these students don't have cars, and even the ones who are going to get transported from Meriden to the main campus in Middletown, the Middlesex Community College campus isn't on like a train route, or I mean, it's kind of like in that little hook of the river there. So, I mean, Malloy keeps talking about his transportation program. Well, this is kind of an anti-transportation program.
Well, dating back years ago, our reporter Siri Gress, when she was working with us, we did a whole series about what towns along that commuter rail line were doing to prepare. And Meriden was at the top of the list. Meriden was investing far before this because they said a transit-oriented development hub around the train station is going to be one of the things that brings back a downtown for a city that's maybe become a little stale. And Meriden's been putting a lot into this. What you're saying essentially, Colin, is here's a place where you could actually do the thing they're talking about, invest in college students, feet on the street, actually living around a transit hub.
Okay, and then lastly, as has been highly publicized, the Board of Regents, you know, who basically, as far as I can tell, live like Aerosmith or something. They had another $700,000 round of raises for top management in this particular college system. So there's money for that as well. But yeah, I mean, not only do you maybe you think you've made an affirmative decision about what Meriden should be. Well, it just seems like all of this stuff ought to be pulling in the same direction. You know, you shouldn't have a Board of Regents deciding to kill off Meriden if you're spending a lot of money in other sectors of the budget to, in fact, build up Meriden. At least talk to each other, at least kind of pull in the same direction.
Do we have any thoughts on this? Keith, Daniela, Keith?
I don't think this proposal is pretty close to the category that I like to call better than the deadest plan in Deadonia. I just don't see the legislature going forward with this plan.
Mm. Well, also, we should point out that, that the co-chair of the higher education panel that will be looking at this is from Meriden, right?
Well, and so there's that. Quick, we're going to go to some other cuts in just a moment. I quickly want to get to a phone call here. Chris is calling from Mansfield. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling about the article that was front page of the Hartford Current this Sunday, detailing a number of places where the Department of Developmental Services spends large sums of money, $19,000 and more, providing overtime expenses to care for people at Southbury Training School. And there's been a lot of discussion about this issue this year in the legislature, and some folks are saying these funds could be applied to folks, families that don't have any resources being given to them, who are in badly needing these resources. And I'm wondering if that's going to have any traction.
Thank you very much for the question. Daniela?
Yeah, that was a very interesting story by my colleague, Josh Kovner. There has been for several years, and I think it's ramping up, a movement afoot by some of the parents who have just the most incredible, heartbreaking stories of children that they're struggling to care for on their own with literally no help from the state or very minimal help from the state. And yet then you read, you know, that there's just – such small numbers being helped at Southbury Training School. I mean, it does appear that there's got to be some type of a major overhaul. I think they're going to be at the Capitol today, actually, the parents and the other advocates. You know, pretty clear that something really needs to be done because a lot of these kids are getting older, the parents are getting older, and there's just some real struggles for them.
Another group that's going to be at the state capitol today, folks who support the arts and humanities, among the groups that are seeing big cuts in the latest round of budget cuts here, Connecticut Humanities, it funds more than 200 museums and libraries across Connecticut. They're talking about all state funding being cut, $2 million, Keith. And so essentially the folks there say, well, this just does us in. I mean, where do we find the money to do the programming that goes across the state if it doesn't come from the state of Connecticut?
That argument carries a lot of weight. It has a lot of traction with the rank-and-file lawmakers who know the voters back in their district will get it. If we saw this close, or Representative Jane Doe allowed that to close. I think all of that is building up pressure. I go back to this idea that we've put 12 Band-Aids on this patient and everybody's going to see the stitches in this analogy are the income tax. If we do an income tax increase, we can undo so many of these ugly little maneuvers. I think this is just going to add to the pressure for some type of major revenue hike.
And it's one of those things, Colin, where, as Keith puts it, the lawmakers then have to face the people in their communities. And sometimes it has to do with social service cuts, the type that we've been talking about quite a bit. Sometimes it has to do with, you know, just closing a really important art institution or a museum in our community. These are all things that do resonate back at home. And maybe it starts to set the bar in motion if you have enough people up at the Capitol saying, this is something we just really can't afford to cut to save $2 million.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, it goes back to the previous conversation we're having about millionaires and billionaires leaving to go someplace else. Part of the answer to why doesn't any of us move to South Dakota or someplace where the taxes are lower, it's because we like it here. We like whatever the character is here. That one of the components of that is arts. Another component is humanities. Humanities, one of the roles of the humanities is to teach us who we are and why we are here. And, you know, it's whenever we get into this kind of Michael Vick style of budgeting where you put two dogs in a pit and let them fight it out, it's hard to make the case for the arts and humanities over programs for the poor, for the most vulnerable people. But there is a role for all this stuff. And it does tie in somehow to why people live in Connecticut, even though the cost of living in Connecticut may be a little higher.
I was just going to say, plus, I know I heard somewhere recently, apparently Aerosmith lives in Connecticut.
Right. Yeah, well, exactly. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the things that they're talking about at the state capitol that don't have necessarily to do with the state budget. And Danielle has been covering some of those. Before we move on, though, just very quickly, we saw the governor talking about his big transportation plan once again out in front of the I-84 viaduct. You know, this is the crumbling highway that cuts right through the heart of downtown Hartford. It has way more traffic on it than it ever should have. It's part of his overarching transportation plan. Just Keith, very quickly, how does this plan, which is like a 30-year plan to rebuild bridges and roadways, how does it tie in at all with some of the budget things that we're seeing right now, or does it?
Right. Honestly, nobody's completely sure how it ties in, but most of the work doesn't really get started until 2020. Most of the money is not needed for about 5 years. And I think the big thing is the timing. The governor wants to have his panel of experts figure out how to pay for this over the summer, as presumably the legislature comes in sometime in the fall. If they have to do a big income tax increase or any type of big tax increase in May just to balance the regular budget, what are the odds they're going to want to come back in October, commit to another, whether it's tolls or gas tax hikes, other revenue increase for transportation, and then 2 months after that enter a re-election year? I think the problem is they may just be trying to pull off too much at one time.
But Daniela, I mean, to Keith's earlier point, some of these bridges and roadways and things, these do resonate back home. These are things that lawmakers and their constituents really do want to see done, if not tomorrow, at least sometime while we're all still, you know, alive and breathing.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, everybody – well, most people drive. Most people use the road. So, yeah, it's it is important for sure.
A lot of people are using CT Fast Track, though, now.
That's because it's out there.
Yeah. This goes back just really quickly to the point I made about before the election. The expectations the public had were this was going to be an easy time. So they're still dealing with the shock that, what do you mean it's not? And I might be talking about a tax increase. If they were in a better mood, because I agree with you, the transportation investment is huge and they might be receptive to it.
One thing that we can tell you is that there is no one who has any nostalgia for the viaduct. There isn't anybody who's going to say, man, I'm going to miss that viaduct. but it's going to be interesting as they get down to planning it, because I have more questions than answers. One of the questions that I have, I mean, one of the things that is said about the viaduct is it divides neighborhoods up. It cuts one part of Hartford off from the other. If you drop it to grade level, I don't understand why it doesn't do that more. In other words, the good thing about the viaduct right now is you could go under it and get from one place to another. If you have a grade level highway running through that same area. I mean, I'm sure this is a stupid thing to bring up because I'm sure somebody has thought about this and figured this out. But at least sort of intuitively, I don't understand how dropping it to grade fixes the problem.
Which is why one of the plans that is being considered is just putting it in an underground tunnel. And
right.
you saw what happened in Boston with the big dig. That will take 150 years to do. Colin McEnroe is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Keith Vanniff is state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Danielle Altomare is state house reporter for the Hartford Current. When we come back, we'll be talking about more about what they're talking about at the state capitol right now that doesn't necessarily have to do with the state budget. That's next in the Wheelhouse, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the shocking video out of South Carolina has race and policing back on the front page once again. We're going to learn what a new CCSU report tells us about racial profiling and traffic stops in Connecticut. We'll also listen back to a conversation we held in New Haven about police transparency in Connecticut, featuring New Haven's police chief and also the chief state's attorney, Kevin Kane. That's tomorrow's program, Where We Live. Today, we're in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, with Keith Vanniff, Daniela Altomare, and Colin McEnroe. Colin, just very quickly, police profiling, of course, is back in the news because of this awful video that, I mean, I can't even believe it is as you watch it. And if you haven't seen it, you probably should take 4 minutes and watch it. But, you know, just this week at the Capitol, the folks at CCSU, folks from the African American Affairs Commission, they're all detailing what we've learned about the state's Alvin Penn law and how state police are counting up traffic stops by race. And it shows that a certain number of towns, Granby, Waterbury, state police troops in Hartford and Tolland and some other towns, have significantly more stops of ethnic minorities than other departments. As our own Ray Hardman reported yesterday, they also talk about something called a veil of darkness, which is, I think, a really interesting idea that there's actually quite a bit more stops of African Americans in daylight than there is at night, when a police officer might not be able to tell the race of the driver. Given what we saw in this video out of South Carolina, and given the fact that this was indeed a traffic stop, what should we be talking about right here as these things all come together?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one of the most interesting conversations that I've had this year about this, I mentioned it on a previous Wheelhouse, was with Doug Glanville, who's been up there promoting a bill that, I mean, it has to do with crossing town lines and in looking for a suspect. So it's not exactly the same as this. But, I mean, he made an interesting point, which is, you know, police see a traffic stop as a chance to find something out, something that could be really important. But citizens, particularly citizens of color, see a traffic stop as the beginning of a chain of events in which any number of things can go wrong. And obviously the most catastrophic version of that is Charleston. But, you know, in general, this is a chance for a lot of things to go wrong. And this really is a problem we have to fix. These disparities, the disparities that were shown yesterday, I mean, they're serious. I believe they're real and they're fixable. This is one of those problems we could actually fix. And you know, if there's anything, so many of the problems we're talking about today are intractable. This isn't one of them.
And I know the people at the state capitol were hearing this testimony, Danielle. I mean, are you hearing anything from lawmakers about really taking some of this information they gathered quite seriously and maybe doing something in Connecticut?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was thinking back to, you know, the mid-90s when I first came to the Hartford Current, and we were writing about, one of the first stories I remember writing about was the Barkhamsted Express back in the Avon Police Department. Involving the Avon Police Department stopping motorists. And, you know, we wrote a lot about it and there were lawsuits and there were discussions, but it was really all on the town level, never, you know, percolated up to the legislature. It never became sort of a topic of conversation, you know, in the broadest sense or looking at public policy changes. And I think now, finally, because of all these things that are happening, I think people are taking this stuff as seriously as they should have, you know, two decades ago.
One thing that you've been writing about, Danielle, activists hoping to convince the legislature to stop the reappointment of State Supreme Court Chief Justice Chase Rogers. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, this comes from sort of a loose coalition of groups who are unhappy with the courts, and they're using the reappointment of the Chief Justice as, you know, sort of a way to, you know, to get at some of that anger and frustration. You know, in reality, how much she has to do with a lot of the things that they're angry about is, you know, certainly up to question. I mean, but there's a lot of disenchantment. I know you've done shows on the guardian ad litem. You know the emotions that are present there. There are people that are unhappy with the foreclosure process. There are people that just have a lot of discontent with the court system in general, and they're using this as a way to sort of galvanize that anger.
Is this the way to galvanize anger around the court system, Colin?
Well, it's a way to galvanize anger. I don't know if it's actually the way to get anything done. I mean, really, I mean, I think it's kind of silly, to be honest with you. I mean, Chase Rogers is not the person who's going to be able to fix this stuff. I mean, she is not an activist Chief Justice of the Supreme Court as these things go anyway. But even the ones who were activists, I mean, that kind of wholesale working of the judicial system isn't really even necessarily the purview of the Chief Justice. I'd start talking to the Chief Court Administrator first and a bunch of other people. I mean, the Judiciary Committee probably has as much to say about this as anything else. So when you're putting up billboards, you know, saying Chase, I mean, it's like you really have picked the wrong target. And it looks like you're having a tantrum that you haven't really thought out very carefully.
Let's talk about a couple things quickly that are happening at the state capitol right now, Danielle, that you've been covering that don't really have to do with the world of the budget. I suppose they could. Mm-hmm. You know, in years past, aid in dying legislation has failed in the state legislature. It's something that is really very important in state houses all around the country right now. Where does this legislation in its form right now stand?
Well, the deadline for the Judiciary Committee to approve its bills is Monday. So Monday at 5 o'clock, we will presumably have an answer, if not before, as to where this stands this year, whether it has traction or not. Certainly, you know, a lot of passion on both sides. So we'll see if, you know, it gets out of the committee. And then obviously it faces an uphill battle. I mean, the governor himself is, you know, not really he said he's wrestled with this. He doesn't really have a clear stance at this point that he's articulated. He says he's struggling with it. So who knows?
Something else the Judiciary Committee was hearing, there's already a medical marijuana program in place in the state. They passed a bill that would expand it and would allow children with certain illnesses to legally mm-hmm. use marijuana.
Yeah, and again, this was the subject of a public hearing a couple of weeks back. Very emotional testimony from parents. One mother brought her son there who was wearing a helmet and has a very severe form of epilepsy. For him to sit through this hearing for hours and hours, you could just tell how difficult that was. Very, very moving testimony. Obviously, there's opposition as well. People are saying that, you know, this is untested in children's brains. We don't know what the impact will be. So
we always talk about this, Keith, about the bills, the things that have strong constituencies on one side or the other. Maybe they're very controversial. They often take years and years and years to get through this process. How does this all knit in with the world you cover around the state budget? Because it seems to many of us that state lawmakers have this big thing on their plate. Mm-hmm. Do we have enough money to fund the government? How will we find the money, or how will we make the cuts to do it? How do stories like this and issues like this weave in?
Sure. I think what happens is people seem so stunned when all of a sudden they're confronted with why is somebody proposing to close a community college or something else? Where did this come from? And they're not looking at the fiscal pressures that drove all these things. And that's where I think when you get a mass of controversial proposals, that's when people start looking at things like, again, a major revenue hike. They say, okay, how can we, you know, give this like a, you know, a B12 shot to the state budget, and so that we don't have to deal with these things? I should have pointed out real quickly earlier, if somebody's hearing us talk a lot about a revenue increase and you want to look at different revenues the state has and sort of build your own tax hike or tax cut, you can go to the comptroller's website, osc.ct.gov, and there actually is a revenue calculator. You can see, well, what does the cigarette tax do versus the income tax?
Build my own tax hike.
or build your own tax cut. I don't want to, you know, preclude any options.
Well, now that the NCAA tournaments are over and all of our brackets are done, maybe that's the next thing we can get involved with. You know, last night, of course, the UConn women's basketball team won its 10th national title. Before last night, the Huskies had defeated opponents in the NCAA tournament by an average of more than 37 points. UConn won by just 10 last night. Here's UConn freshman Mike Esposito talking about the game to WNPR's Ryan King.
It was definitely good that it was close. I mean, it's fun being dominant and everything, but it was a lot better of a game.
It was a lot better of a game. We've spoken about the disparity in women's basketball before. Gino Auriemma, before the game, spoke to reporters about his team. Here's some audio from WTNH.
We have, like, iconic players. We have guys that when they get in that game, they think it's like their moment. They live for it. So they shine in those moments. So that's obviously a big part of it. You're not going to show up at the Kentucky Derby with a mule and think you're going to win. Even if you have the best jockey, you ain't going to win.
Okay, Gino Auriemma. First of all, Colin, congratulations to Gino and his team. It's a story that I think a lot of us probably take for granted. We've been talking a lot in the last couple of days about, is Mike Krzyzewski one of the greatest coaches or the greatest coach in men's college basketball? Gino Auriemma doesn't get the respect that John Wooden, who also won 10 titles back in the 1960s with his men's UCLA team, does. But maybe there's some similarities here. Maybe, I don't know, the UConn of today is the UCLA of back then, and the women's college game of today is sort of like the men's college game of the 1960s. Should we be looking at Gino in maybe a different way and giving him more props than we even do?
Well, and I think Connecticut does look at Gino that way. The question is, does the rest of the country – I mean, as I've said in the past, one of the problems for women's basketball is there are maybe 8 to 10 hotbed markets for collegiate markets, basically, for women's basketball. And the rest of the country is – I mean, if you like look at – I don't know. Last night, just as the game was ending, I just pulled up my Twitter feed. Now, keep in mind, my Twitter feed has like a lot of Connecticut people in it, just to see whether people in general were talking about this. And, you know, I mean, they're kind of not. I mean, outside of Connecticut, they're kind of not. It just doesn't get the same kind of attention. But I think here in Connecticut, we do realize what Gino is, and he is all those things. And I think the comparisons to Wooden are apt. He's a great recruiter of a certain kind of talent, places a certain kind of emphasis on character, and then plays the game the right way. The one thing I would say is I wish Connecticut – I don't know how you can fix this, but, you know, Connecticut, they completely adjust their vocabulary when they're talking about the UConn women. A 10-point win is not a close game. It's just not a close game. A 1-point win or a 2-point win, that's a close game. Dayton did not put a scare into Connecticut. Connecticut won that game by 20 points or more. At halftime, it was close. But that's not a scare. I mean, there's no men's basketball team in the country that wins by 20 points and then says, boy, they really put a scare in us. We need to sort of at least start talking about this stuff the way it really is.
Of course, one thing that always happens around big sporting events is politicians make these friendly bets with each other during events. You know, so Governor Malloy and Indiana Governor Mike Pence bet some local agricultural products last year when UConn and Notre Dame once again met in the Women's College Basketball Championship game. Last night, no goods were exchanged. A Malloy spokesman told Hearst Connecticut Media, not sure that Governor Pence would pick up the phone. This, of course, due to Governor Malloy's ban on state-funded travel to Indiana last week. Malloy's ban was revoked over the weekend, but the hard feelings between the two seem to remain. That's all the time we have in the wheelhouse today. I want to thank our guests who joined us, Daniela Altomare, who's State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. Thanks so much, Daniela.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Keith Vanoff. He's state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thanks.
Our intern today is Sydney Laura. We got production help from Natalia Altamari. We also have the cameras of CTN here. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyle Wolf. The digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. You've got 15 seconds, Colin. Tell them about your event tonight.
David Edelstein, America's Greatest Living Film Critic at Watkinson School at 7. We still have tickets, I think. Call Watkinson School or go to Watkinson.org.
This is Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.